Welcome to Historians on the Record, brought to you by the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. I'm Jim Basker, president of the Institute. Our mission is to promote the study and love of American history through programs such as these. Please visit us on the web at www.gilderlehrman.org to sign up for our mailing list and learn more about our resources for teachers and students.
Progressivism was one of the great reform movements in American history. It began around 1900, and it lasted until about 1920. The dates cannot be exact, because it did not have a formal beginning, and it did not have a formal end. The name progressive comes from a political party that Theodore Roosevelt started in 1912. Theodore Roosevelt, a great figure in American history, had been president from 1901 to 1909, could have run for a second or really a third term, chose not to, but he was a very young man when he retired from the presidency. He was only in his 40s, and he went, he thought he would do other things. He thought he would retire. The 40s are kind of a young time to retire for someone who's feeling youthful. He went to Africa to shoot big game for a couple years, came back to America, found it to be in a worse place than it had been when he had left. He had been a Republican president. His successor was in the White House, William Howard Taft. Roosevelt effectively told Taft, "You are not doing a good job. Move out of the way, buddy. I'm coming back." Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of William Howard Taft, but he was a big buddy. He was a very large man, over 300 pounds. He was literally hard to move out of the way, and he had no intention of moving aside for Theodore Roosevelt. And so Theodore Roosevelt did not like to be rebuffed. He was a very headstrong individual, used to getting his way in one form or another. And so when Taft said, "I'm running on the Republican ticket in 1912, Roosevelt said, "All right, I'm going to run against you." He ran against Taft. Arguably, he won the primary election. But in that period, many political elections were fixed in one way or another. They were not honest. And the Republican Party fixed this election so that Taft would win. And he was the nominee. Roosevelt considered this to be unacceptable. And so he founded his own party, a third party. There were the Democrats as there are now. There were the Republicans as there are now. And Theodore Roosevelt in 1912 invents the Progressive Party and asks all the reformers in American life, and there were many reformers in American life, to come to him and to become part of the great progressive movement. This is where the term originates. Roosevelt did not win in 1912. He stopped Taft from getting elected, and because they, in effect, split the Republican vote, they made it possible for a Democrat who had gotten a minority of the votes, a man by the name of Woodrow Wilson, to become president of the United States. He was elected in 1912. He becomes president in 1913. And he, too, dons the progressive mantle. He, too, considers himself to be a progressive president. He, too, commits himself to this reform movement. And so right away, we understand something very important about progressivism. It was not the property of one party or another. It was not just the property of progressivism. It was not just the property of the Republicans. It was not just the property of the Democrats. It was the property of all three. And this clues us into something very important about progressivism, in that it was an incredibly wide-ranging movement of reform, maybe the most wide-ranging movement of reform that we have ever had in American history. What did the progressives want to do? I'm going to give you just a list of things now. And this is just a brief list of the things they wanted to do. They wanted to reform industry and finance. They thought corporations had too much power and banks were causing the ruin of America. Sort of sounds familiar to what we're talking about today. They wanted to reform politics, which they considered corrupt. They wanted to reform the cities, which they thought had become terrible places in which to live. They wanted to give the poor a better deal in life, more opportunity, or what Theodore Roosevelt called the square deal. They wanted to uplift the poor. They thought the poor were living, in many cases, in immoral circumstances. They were drinking too much. There was too much prostitution. There was too much gambling. There was too much vice. The progressives wanted to uplift the poor out of their immorality. They wanted to give women the vote, because only men at the time could vote. And they also wanted to take the vote away from citizens who they deemed to be unfit to vote, who were not deserving to vote. They wanted to make the American Republic, and they wanted to make American democracy really work. They wanted to restore greatness to America. The Promise of American Life was the title of a famous book in the progressive period by a man by the name of Herbert Croly. Progressives felt that the promise of American life had been lost, and they wanted to get it back. They were great optimists. They were great believers in many things, but one of the things they believed in was America, and another thing they believed in was progress, hence the term progressive. They wanted to put America back on its track toward greatness. Now, just to give you a short list of efforts at reform, as I've just done, already begins to make us glaze over, as it has many historians. There are just too many reforms. They're just too varied. We would end up with just a list. So I'm going to come up with a couple devices to help us understand the meaning of progressive reform and also to focus your attention on a few key areas. One indication of the intensity of reform is the number of constitutional amendments passed during the progressive era. Let me ask you a question. How many times, well, let me ask you one other question before I ask you that question. From when does the Constitution date? When did our Constitution become the law of the land? That's a question for you. When did the American Constitution become the law of the land? Anybody know? There's a partial hand over there. No? When did the Constitution begin? When did America begin? I'm sorry? Yeah? When did America begin? 1800s? A little louder? America? I'm sorry, is there a hand there? No? Someone want to be brave? Raise a hand? Yes? 1776. You got it exactly. That's when America had been colonies of Britain. They declared their independence. They fought for their freedom. They became a confederation. The government of the 13 colonies was not working, so they wrote a new document called the Constitution, which went into effect after 1776, and when? July what year? Yes. 1788? Very close. That's when they gathered to draft it. It actually became law of the land 1789 and 1790. This remains the guiding principle of our government, and it is now one of the oldest, if not the oldest, written constitution in the world, and has served us very well. How many amendments to the Constitution have there been? There's the water again. Since that time. How many times have Americans said we must amend our fundamental law? I'm sorry? 13, a good guess. Double that and add one. 27. 27 times the Constitution has been amended. So not very often. 27 times in more than 200 years. We do not take the Constitution lightly. We do not amend it often. We only amend it when something is seriously wrong in this country and when there's serious agreement on what to do about what is wrong. So 10 of those amendments were passed immediately after the Constitution. They are called the Bill of Rights. So take the 10 out of the 27. That leaves 17 for more than 200 years. That comes to about one every 14 years. Four of those amendments were passed during the Progressive Era. Four of those amendments were passed between 1900 and 1920. Four were passed between 1913 and 1920. And my trivia question for you today is, what are those amendments? Mr. Napoli mentioned one already. What are those amendments? Anyone know? There's another hand here. Yes. Women's suffrage. Women were given the right to vote. Absolutely, that's one. Now, I should also say, when I have trivia questions like this, I like to give out Snickers bars. I know you, I was not allowed in this school with a big Snickers bar because it violates the anti-candy policy, which is a good policy. But I managed from one of the administrators to get some very small Snickers pieces. And for each of you who gets an amendment, you get a Snickers piece at the end of this lecture. So you've just won your first Snickers piece. So you've got one amendment. Now the hands are going up. I got your attention. So one amendment is giving women the right to vote. Yes. Two more. Prohibiting alcohol. You got two more. You get two Snickers pieces after lecture today. One is prohibiting the sale and distribution of alcohol, known as prohibition. And another was instituting a federal income tax, which, as Mr. Napoli said, gives the government right to tax, the federal government the right to tax personal incomes. And so we got three, and we need one more. Yes, in the front here. How the Senate was composed. So you're absolutely right. There's a new way of electing senators. What was the old way, and what was the new way? Uh-huh. Okay, the new way is two senators from each state for six-year terms. That actually continues what had been in place already. So it's another, it has to do with who elects the senators. Yes, question here. I'm sorry? People elect the senators, yep. And who had elected the senators before this time? Legislature, the state legislatures, yes. So the Fourth Amendment, you get a Snickers, and you get a bite of the Snickers. This was an amendment before that time, senators were elected by state legislatures, meeting among themselves, and the decision is made in the Progressive Era to make the election of senators direct. The people themselves elect the senators of the United States, two senators from every state. So think about these amendments. It gives you a sense of the diversity of reform. Two of them concern elections. The progressives were very concerned about politics and about voting. So those two amendments are giving women the right to vote and allowing the people to elect their own senators directly without the intermediaries of the state legislatures that were thought to be corrupt. So the progressives are very interested in politics. What is taxing income about? In its largest sense, taxing income is the government saying we have a right to a portion of what you earn because we have to regulate this economy. This economy cannot regulate itself. Leaving people with all the money they make is going to lead to problems. So this was the progressive effort to enter into the economic realm. And the other amendment, prohibition, speaks to the moral dimension of progressivism. It speaks to the conviction that many progressives had that many Americans were not living moral lives. And one piece of evidence that they were not living moral lives is that they were drinking too much. Husbands were spending their wages on booze, going out with the guys after a long workday instead of going home and giving that money to the family to help them. So, looking at the range of amendments, I want you to remember this, there's no other period in American history, other than the Bill of Rights itself, when four amendments were passed in only 8 years. And those four amendments cover such a wide range of issues, it gives you a sense for the extraordinary range of progressive reform. Branching out from that, this is how I would like to ask you to think about progressivism. The progressives, those who call themselves progressive reformers, became concerned about four big problems in American life. And these four problems, in their view, overwhelmed every other. And to help you understand what these problems are, I've put a very simple slide up here that I'll be referring to. The first was the economic problem. What was the economic problem? America was undergoing enormous growth. Industries had become very powerful. The energy of capitalism had been unleashed. All kinds of new goods were being produced. America was being transformed from a rural nation to an urban nation. All kinds of people were being drawn to work in America. All kinds of people who lived in other parts of the world were immigrating to America to work in this enormously expanding and industrializing economy. Now, initially, this enormous expansion generated great hopes. But by the late 19th century, by the 1880s, the 1890s, there is a sense that this economic machine is out of control. That Americans were separating into two very large and separate groups. On one side were the very, very rich, the plutocrats, the owners of industry, people making millions, tens of millions of a year, the equivalent of today's billionaires. On the other side were masses of Americans who were impoverished, who couldn't make ends meet, who couldn't figure out how to have a family, who couldn't have hope because they had no opportunity for economic improvement. There was a sense that America, which was supposed to be for common men and women, was becoming a place only for the elite, and the poor were being abandoned. Not only that, even the rich were worried. Even those who had made an enormous amount of money out of industry were worried because this economy was being shaken by an accelerating pattern of boom and bust. There'd be a couple great economic boom years, and then there'd be a terrible bust. And during years of a bust, like we have experienced in America in the last year and a half, unemployment rises, businesses go bankrupt, tremendous amount of hardship is generated. And so even those who were at the top benefiting from this enormous expansion began to worry that the system was no longer working anymore. And the conviction spreads among progressives that the sources of the problem are leaving industry on its own, that the government has to begin to come in and regulate this economy, regulate this industry to bring more stability and to spread more opportunity. But how to do this? This brings us to the second problem, the political problem. American politics, the progressives thought, they're completely corrupt. You can't get anything changed. Your legislators are bought. In New Jersey, a state I lived for 25 years. This is not why I left, though. It was felt. I love New Jersey. But for many years, New Jersey was known. It was known that the railroad companies ran New Jersey. They determined who would be governor. They would determine who controlled the legislature. They would get whatever they wanted out of New Jersey. There were many other states like this. Minnesota always had an independent streak. So it was never among the most corrupt states. But in state after state, those reformers who were trying to do things felt that they were stymied because money ruled politics. And all the talk about democracy, representation, the people being sovereign was only that, just talk. It had no meaning. And so there was no chance of regulating the economy unless you could have a meaningful politics. How do you get a meaningful politics? How do you take politics back? How do you take politics back from the political machines? How do you release politics from the grip of money? And progressives spent an enormous amount of time thinking about politics, and one expression of their solution was the direct election of senators. Put the people in charge, take this very important process out of the control of state legislatures. There was also a knowledge problem. What do we mean by a knowledge problem? Americans had textbooks, just like you have textbooks. What do you think of your textbooks? You believe them? You like them? No? Why not? They're boring. They have words. That's a problem. Well, maybe in 50 years we'll just have textbooks with pictures. But there'll probably always be some words in textbooks. Progressives in the 1890s, first decade of the 20th century, felt similarly to you. They were bored by what they were being taught. And not only that, one of the reasons they were bored, why are you bored with textbooks? Partly because scholars often don't write very well, don't write in an interesting way. But another reason that you get bored is you say, what? If I'm learning about a textbook in American history, or if I'm learning civics about how the government works, what relations does this textbook really help me understand how America works? Does it really help me understand how people get elected? Does it really help me understand how policy gets passed? And the feeling among the progressives, the answer was no. They had all this wisdom. They had all this stuff about one man, one vote. Well, they said women can't vote, plus a lot of men can't vote. The people aren't really sovereign. The people don't really control things. Our textbooks are not telling us what we really need to know. And one of the cries of progressives was for new knowledge. Give us new knowledge. Give us new ways of understanding the world. Help us understand America not as it's supposed to be. Help us understand America as it really is. And so progressives began generating all new forms of knowledge. And a lot of what we call the social sciences today, including history and sociology and political science, economics, are all born at this time. New knowledge. There are new ways of looking at the world, new philosophies to help Americans understand what was going on around them. In other words, they reacted to their boredom not by saying, I won't read. They reacted to their boredom by saying, give us something that really has some meaning. Give us something that really helps us understand the world in which we live. You give me that, I'll read it. And I'll do something about it. So that was the knowledge problem. Give us knowledge that really helps us understand America. And then there was the morals problem. There were a lot of problems in the cities. Poverty, family breakdown, alcoholism, prostitution, gambling, frittering away hard-earned resources, economic calamity, political paralysis, plus deep ignorance led in the eyes of progressives to despair. And from despair, there was moral decline. People didn't really have hope. And so they allow themselves to become immoral. And the progressives wanted to change that. So think of the agenda they set for themselves. The economy's not working. The political system's not working. We don't have the knowledge we need. And there are growing problems of immorality in the city. And the progressives set out, and they said, we're going to tackle all these problems. What gave them the confidence that they could do that? What gave them the confidence at this moment of difficulty that they could take on the world? Not an easy question to answer. But let me say this about the progressives. They had a lot of faith. What did they have faith in? Many had faith in God. Progressivism was a very religious movement. Many of its strongest adherents were Protestant churchgoers and very devout. Tremendous faith in God that they could set this right. They also had tremendous faith in government. They felt that they could make government a tool to correct the ills of American society. They had faith in progress. And their faith in progress had two components. One was a faith in reason. Progressives had great belief in reason. They said, if we understand a problem, we can solve it. We have great reasoning, analytical faculties. We can solve this problem. And they also had the faith in progress is also a faith in America. The notion of America as an exceptional place. A place that could do which no other country could do, make a good life for all its people. And you see the faith in America in the words that progressives choose to describe what they're doing. We will build a new republic, they say. We will build a new democracy. These are their words, not mine. We will build a new freedom. Those were Woodrow Wilson's. That's the campaign slogan of 1912 for Woodrow Wilson. We will build a new freedom. And then back to the promise of American life. Great faith that America had gone off the rails, but that the promise of American life endured and could be reclaimed. And this is what gave the progressives faith to take on such a huge agenda. Any questions? Okay, I want to take a few more moments to talk about how progressives went about solving particular problems in the different areas that I have set forth for you here. With regard to the economic problem, I want to focus your attention briefly on the election of 1912, where Theodore Roosevelt is running on the progressive ticket. The biggest issue of 1912 was what to do about the trusts. We don't use the word trusts anymore, and that's why I've put it in quotation marks on this slide here. But by trusts, the progressives meant the big corporations. The biggest issue in 1912 was what to do about corporate power in American life. There were four candidates, serious candidates, running for president in 1912. A couple I've mentioned. William Howard Taft was running on the Republican ticket. He said, corporations don't have too much power, don't worry about it. He gets 25% of the vote. He does very badly. There's Theodore Roosevelt running on the Progressive Party ticket. He says, we must regulate the corporations. We must build government strong enough so that it has power over the corporations to make sure they are operating in the public interest. Then there was Woodrow Wilson, who said, break up all the big corporations. It's not working. Get rid of the big corporations. What are the big corporations in America today? I'm sorry? GM. Give me an example of a good corporation that's not already falling apart. Give me an example of a corporation that exerts enormous power over American life. Yes? Exxon. So what would Woodrow Wilson say about Exxon? Break it up. In fact, that's what they did to the predecessor of Exxon in the progressive period. They broke it up. What would Woodrow Wilson say about Microsoft? That's a powerful. What would they say about Google? These are powerful corporations. Woodrow Wilson would say, break it up. What would he say about Intel? Break it up. These are monopolies. They are squeezing the opportunity out of American life. There's no chance for an ordinary company to get ahead. Let's go back 50 years earlier. That's what Woodrow Wilson is saying. And then there's Eugene Victor Debs. Anybody know who Eugene Victor Debs was and what party he was running on? I hear little murmurings. Anybody want to take a chance? He's running on the Socialist Party ticket. And he's well-regarded, well-respected. He said, this is what we're going to do about the corporations. We're going to simply take them over. We're just going to have the government own all the corporations and run them in the people's interests. So think about this election. Taft says there's no problem with the corporations. He gets trounced. The other candidates, who all say the biggest problem is the power of the corporations, they split the other 75% of the vote. Think about this. Three out of four Americans voting are saying something must be done about the trusts. Those who vote for Roosevelt say regulate them. Those who vote for Wilson say break them up. Those who vote for Debs say take them over. Wilson wins. And what's Wilson's promise? I'm sorry? Yeah, we'll break them up. Wilson says, break them up. Wilson wins. He doesn't break them up. Imagine if today a presidential candidate says, I'm coming into power and I'm breaking up Intel, Google, Microsoft, Exxon, any other big corporation in American life. How would they be greeted? With fear. So Wilson, am I okay?
Yes.
Wilson says, I'm going to break them up. But when he gets into office, he doesn't break them up. He becomes like Roosevelt. He says, I'm not going to break them up. That's too radical. But I am going to regulate them. So the progressive solution to the problem of corporations is to put government oversight over them, to regulate them in the public interest. This is what most Americans want, and this is what most Americans get. Political reform, the political problem. I want to focus your attention on one aspect of it, and that is creating a virtuous electorate. And can someone tell me how much more time I have before 10 minutes? Creating a virtuous electorate. The progressives said, we've got to clean up politics. In some respects, that means getting rid of political machines, corrupt politicians. But that also means making everyone in America who votes a virtuous caster of their vote. And all kinds of reforms come in to do this. One is creating the secret ballot. Before progressivism, if you voted, you voted in public. If you were voters and you were, say, at a workplace, the election day would come around in November and you say, let's all go to the polls together and let's all cast our votes. And you'd all cast your votes in public. You wouldn't do it privately. And the progressives said, this is no good. We got to get rid of this. They get rid of this. They also say, we need to bring more virtue into the political process. We are going to give women the vote. This is what some progressives said. We are going to give women the vote because they are naturally more virtuous than men. Is that true, by the way? Are women more naturally virtuous than men? What does that mean? That they have a stronger moral character to them. Yes? Anyone who thinks that women have naturally more virtue than men, raise your hands. Anyone who thinks that men have more virtue than women, raise your hands. Okay, those who think women have more virtue win this poll. Well, the progressives thought exactly like you did. They thought men had a greater tendency to immorality, to vice, to gambling, to prostitution, to wasting money, to alcoholism, to not telling the truth. So one of the reasons for bringing women into politics was to say, we are going to make politics more moral. We're going to bring mothers into politics. They are going to moralize the political system. They are going to lend virtue and honesty. This becomes a major motivation for bringing women into the political sphere. The progressives also do something else, which is not so nice. They say, is voting a right or is it a privilege? What do you think? Is voting a right or is it a privilege? All right. We have a rights contingent over here. And we have a privilege contingent over here. The progressives sided with the privilege contingent. The progressives said, voting is a privilege, and you got to be a good citizen in order to earn the right to vote. Yes. One of the things they said in the southern states was that if you were black, you were inferior, and you would not have the right to vote. This is one of the things progressives say. They also said, if you're an immigrant and you don't speak English, we're going to make it difficult for you to vote. We're going to lay on all kinds of regulations that's going to make hard for you to understand where to vote, how to vote, because we don't really trust you. It's one of the contradictions of this very hopeful movement that this faith in America leads a big group of progressives to say certain Americans should not be voting. And this becomes an era of what's called disfranchisement, a very big word about something very important, stripping the vote from Americans who should have it as a right. This is part of what the progressives are doing in terms of creating a virtuous electorate. They are, on the one hand, giving women the vote, because that's going to bring more virtue in. On the other hand, they're excluding people on the basis of race and where they were born, because they're saying these people are biologically or constitutionally incapable of voting in a responsible way. Every political movement has a dark side, and this is a very dark side of progressivism. And this is something we may want to talk about in the questions and answers. Yes. You have to speak up a little so I can hear you. The political party. Were the political parties strong then? Which political parties were strongest? Like today, the Democrats and the Republicans ruled the roost. The Republicans were more dominant than the Democrats were. But because the Republicans, in effect, split between Roosevelt and Taft, that allowed a Democrat to be elected president, and he became arguably the greatest progressive president, and that is Woodrow Wilson. So the Republicans and the Democrats were the powerful parties of that time. Yes? Is there a progressive party today? Officially not. The Progressive Party survives into the 1940s and 50s, but only as something very small. There are people who call themselves progressives today as a way of affiliating themselves with this older movement that they admire a lot. But the official Progressive Party no longer exists in America. Very briefly about solving two other problems, and then I'm done, and I'm going to listen to more of your questions. The knowledge problem. Americans are not being taught or not learning what they ought to know. The progressives were a great believer in facts. They wanted to know everything. And one way in which they learned is if they had a problem they didn't know anything about, they established a commission. What's a problem in Minneapolis in the Twin Cities that you don't know enough about? What's a problem here that you don't know enough about in your urban life here? Do you know enough about education? Yeah? Okay. No? The progressives would set up a commission on education. What other problems are there in the city? Economics. Economic poverty. They would set up on a commission on that. These would be city commissions run by the city government. Is there a problem? Is there a perception of problems of immigrants in terms of assimilating into American life and adapting and transitioning? Is that considered to be an issue in Minneapolis politics? Progressives would set up a commission to study it. Great believers in facts, great believers in learning, great believers in knowledge. Give us the knowledge and we can act. And finally, the morals problem. Uplifting the poor. Taking care of them. This had both a very sympathetic side. There were people like Jane Addams, who's in your book. Find the picture of her. Who's in your primary book. One of the great reformers in all of American history. From an upper middle class home, living in the suburbs of Chicago, gave up all her entitlement and all her private money to go live in one of the poorest districts of Chicago, the 18th Ward, which was populated almost entirely by immigrants, very poor, very hard. She said to other women like her who had gone to college, come with me, live with me, let us live among the poor, let us help them in any way we can. And from these very little beginnings began a very great movement for reform that was at the ground level, that sought to deal with issues and problems where people lived and where people were at. And she became a great figure of American progressivism this way. There was also a condescending element to the morals, the dealing with the morals problem. There was a sense that poor people did not always know their best interest, and that they needed more educated people to come in and tell them how to live, and they needed people to come in and tell them whether they could drink or not, or how to spend their money. So there was a conservative and a condescending element to this morals problem. which gave it a more conservative cast. But this also was a crucial part of progressivism. So what came of progressivism? Many things. This was the beginning of serious regulation of industry and finance. This was the beginning of a long period of serious efforts to improve political institutions. This was a period of great advances in knowledge. This was the beginning of an era of improvement in the lives of poor Americans, especially in cities. This was the beginning of a long period of believing in government as a powerful tool of reform. In that respect, Barack Obama is a descendant of the progressives. Many tasks the progressives undertook were left unfinished, but the projects begun by the progressives would be resumed in the 1930s in another reform movement called the New Deal. They would be resumed in the 1960s in another movement called the Great Society. Progressivism would become the major project of the Democratic Party. It would come to be known as liberalism, a political faith that dominated American politics for almost 50 years. Its beginnings are here in progressivism, in the efforts of reformers to solve the four big problems that I've talked about with you today. Thank you very much.